First, we look at new regulations for financial professionals. Millions of Americans use financial planners to invest for their retirement. Most consumers assume that financial advisors were acting in their best interests, much like doctors, but until this past April, that wasn't always the case. Joining us to discuss the new regulations and what it means for consumers and financial professionals is Pam Kruger. She's a former stockbroker and co-host of PBS's Money Track, a program about personal finance and investing. Welcome.
Hi,
should say welcome back.
Yeah.
Also joining us is Jason Lilly, Managing Partner, ARK Wealth Advisors. He's an independent fiduciary advisor, formerly at Rockland Trust, where he oversaw retirement accounts. Welcome, Jason. Good to see you.
Thanks, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Pam, I think first I want to start with something about your program because it's interesting, and you have a new program too, and you're very particular about who's involved and you know, what money you take, that kind of thing. So explain that.
So in addition to the brand new PBS special that we have coming out at the end of the year and that will roll out on PBS stations across the country in early 2017, we'll be focusing, it's Money Track, so it's always about investing. We'll be focusing on money for life. This specifically zooms right into retirees because money for life means making the money that you've saved and you've worked and you've invested last for the rest of your life. But in addition to that, I created a platform online since the last time I was on the show with you. Mm-hmm. And this was a result of our viewers saying to me, hey, Pam, really love your show. You're always giving us good information about how to avoid bad broker behavior and the good, the bad, and the ugly about financial advisors. But you're never telling us where to go online to find them. Mm-hmm. So I developed WealthRamp online to help connect consumers to advisors.
Okay. Let's talk about these regulations, these new rules. This was something that was necessary, but people are going to be surprised that it wasn't already in place, right?
Yeah. So I like to think of this is a new rule that, you know, usually when new rules come around in the financial world, you're like, oh dear, what are they going to do now? They're going to limit my choices as a consumer, as an individual investor, because they don't think I can take care of myself. In this case, this rule really is around financial advisors, investment advisors who are offering advice to retirement savers. That means that if you have your most serious money, which arguably the trillions of dollars in retirement accounts are Americans' most serious money. The rule says, get ready for this, drum roll, advisors now have to act in the best interest of their clients.
Okay. So they didn't have to do that before, Jason.
No. In fact, over this weekend, I was over my mother's house and talking about what we were going to talk about today. And I told her about this fiduciary standard and best interest contract. And she's like, you mean they don't have to act in the best interest of their client? Now, this is a woman who's been saving for the last 30 or 40 years and has used advisors in different capacities mm-hmm. over that time frame, had no idea that there's this suitability versus this fiduciary difference.
So I like to think of this as the young couple. Picture the young couple goes in to make this huge investment in an engagement ring. They're going to buy big, nice, big, expensive diamond. And they walk into a brand name, nationally known, nationally recognized brand name jeweler. And they go through the whole process. They pick out their beautiful diamond and they put it in a bag. And as they're walking out the door together, the jeweler turns around as they're walking out the door and says, oh, kids, by the way, that's a real diamond.
Yeah.
Like, you assume it's going to be, but you never know.
So explain why regulators thought these new rules were necessary. Now, why didn't they do this before? Why now? What happened that made them think this? We have to take care of this now?
Because not all advisors play by the same rules. And we've known this, you know, intuitively on some level forever. And these rules have been in the making forever. And Wall Street, as we know, is built on opaque practices. You don't really want to see behind the curtain. You don't really want to know how much you're paying in fees. We're not really going to tell you because you don't really need to know. You just need to make an investment. So there are really two types of advisors in the world. Those who sell investments, you know, like a traditional stockbroker like I was mm-hmm. when I was in the business, an insurance salesperson who sells retirement. Again, we're focused on retirement investments here. Selling retirement annuities and those kinds of products, air quotes. Okay. And then you have the other advisors who exist who are not so much selling products. They are offering advice and they get a fee for the advice that they're giving you on the investments. So they're two different, very subtle distinctions with a huge line drawn in the sand. Well, the Department of Labor oversees retirement accounts and retirement investors' well-being. And they've said, look, we can't have these two sets of standards because the people who are selling the products, the brokers, the insurance salespeople, are paid mostly on commissions. Call them what they are, kickbacks from the products they sell. So if I have a mutual fund that pays me a huge commission or an index fund that pays me next to nothing, and you're my client, Mindy, mm-hmm. you know, I almost can't help it. It's kind of baked into the cake that I'm motivated to sell you investment A with the higher charge.
It may not be the best investment for me.
It may or it may not, but I'm incentivized to behave that way. Now, the question is that putting you ahead of me? Is that putting your best interests first ahead of my own? No, I'm really working for me instead of you. Department of Labor says no more. Mm-hmm. Every advisor has to meet what's called the fiduciary standard. That's a higher standard.
Yes, and it's really important and relevant in our industry. I've always, before my previous employer, I worked for a large index family giving holistic wealth and financial planning advice, Vanguard Group. So I've always worked in that fiduciary capacity and always competing, I guess, if you could say, against those that are working more on this suitability side of things. So the end result of these new regulations should be good for the average investor who might not be able to differentiate between the two.
866-999-4626 is our number if you have questions this morning. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how might people's investment options change because of these regulations? I can see people listening going, wait a minute, has my advisor been looking out for my best interest? I mean,
well, this is the beauty of the choice. Instead of the government coming in and saying, we're going to restrict the kinds of investments that you, Mindy, consumer, can make, instead they're saying, you know, we want to give consumers choices. We want to empower consumers with knowledge. We want you to understand for the first time how these fees really work. And we want to encourage conversations about asking your advisor, by the way, how much am I paying you? This is not a conversation that people have. We're kind of trained not to bring that up. We tend to sit down with an advisor. If I'm the client, Jason's my advisor, and we just met, generally speaking, you're going to be telling me, Jason, about all the great investments I can make, all the choices there are, and how you can help me. And maybe or maybe not the conversation ever would come up about fees. And
it would with me, but
it would with you.
Yeah. But it doesn't,
because you
some.
Behave yeah. with that the new standard, the higher standard. It's not a new standard, but it's a new standard to this particular conversation. It's called the fiduciary standard, and that just means it's a standard of care that's higher than just simply selling mm-hmm. somebody an investment.
Any solutions, investment advice has to be in the best interest of the client.
Right. And so you have to ask yourself, difference. What are you really paying for? When you go to an investment advisor, two things. You're making an investment that maybe you might not have known about, but really when you break it down, what are you paying for? You want advice. You want guidance. You want validation. You want somebody to hold your hand. Is that worth something? Yes. So if it's worth something, why shouldn't financial advisors be totally upfront and say, this is how much I charge for my advice. This is how much it costs you to buy the investment. We'll go to the lowest cost provider, Vanguard, Schwab, Fidelity, TD, and we'll buy that investment at the lowest cost. But you need to know that you're paying me X for the advice.
So is it too risky for somebody to do it themselves?
No. Not at all.
No, I don't think so. It's not so much about the riskiness. It's about the commitment and what I like to describe as investment composure. So oftentimes, I think one of the greatest values we provide as advisors to our clients isn't necessarily the cool portfolio construction and the asset classes and the mutual fund selections and the individual stocks, you know, the stuff that gets us jazzed up. It's more about the commitment to that long-term strategy. Because oftentimes, while we know markets go up and down, and we know that when they go down, we get a lot less comfortable, and it's much easier to make changes that could actually take you off course. So advisors providing that investment composure through those difficult times is one of the greatest values that we can provide from an investment standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then you have all those other wealth-related issues like college planning, retirement planning. Am I on track to save enough to have a comfortable retirement? And those things, anyone could figure out. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to do that, but it does take time. It takes commitment and consistency as well.
You know, it's also the kind of exercise that's better done in collaboration, because I say 15% of all consumers really truly want to cut their own hair, milk their own cows, right, shear their own sheep, and invest all on their own. Can you do it? Well, yeah, of course. Technology allows you to do everything now, and totally inexpensively and transparently. If it's something like simply generating a portfolio of stocks for yourself, and that's all you're doing, well, sure, you know, something like that makes a lot of sense. But then when you pull in what Jason just said about needing a quarterback in your mm-hmm. life, somebody dies, somebody's selling a business, something happens to you, and you need that quarterback to come in and say, okay, I can coordinate this for you with your taxes, with your attorney, you know, if it's a divorce, whatever the sticky situation is, it's collaborative at that point. Mm-hmm.
I have a fair number of clients that are in my industry that are either in venture capital, or they've been analysts on fixed income or stock side of things, and they either want to delegate the process knowing that they don't have the time or the commitment, or they want to take it off their plate because of behavioral inconsistencies that they want to avoid. Mm.
Now, it's been recommended that we need $1 million by the time we retire. With people living longer, cost of living increases. Has that figure changed? Is that still what most people are looking at?
$1 million! It used to be such a large amount of money, but...
No, not
I
so
mean,
much.
These days, you're talking about we're investing in a zero interest rate environment. You're not getting anything at the bank. It means you have to take some risk. How much risk do you want to take with your nest egg? So all sum in total, what do you say, Jason, between that money, that nest egg mm-hmm. of $1 million might generate between $30,000 and $40,000 a year in spendable income?
Yeah, a good rule of thumb, general rule of thumb, is the industry standard of the 4% spending rule. So take whatever you've saved, let's call it $1 million, and multiply that by 0.04%, and that gives you about $40,000 in spending capacity with a decent likelihood that you'll never run out of money. Not guaranteed that you won't, but the probability looks pretty good that you won't.
And you add in the Social Security.
You get some Social Security.
And all totaled, it's a nice lifestyle, but is it the big $1 million lifestyle that you might have fantasized that $1 million would provide?
One of the challenges is healthcare costs. Mm-hmm. They're rising much faster than inflation, and there's been a number of high-level publications that have come in and around a ballpark of about $250,000 is what you're going to need for healthcare expenses.
Not including long-term care, which on the Cape and in Massachusetts can easily be $6,000, $7,000 a month.
Oh, I think you're closer to $10,000.
Yeah, I think I'm low end. I knew it was expensive, but I didn't know it was that expensive.
Yeah.
Wow. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Pam Kruger, a former stockbroker and co-host of PBS's Money Track, and Jason Lilly, managing partner at ARK Wealth Advisors. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so we talked about this $1 million. Now, let's say we have somebody, well, first of all, it can sound like a lot of money, and we say $1 million isn't what it used to be, but just, you go, wow, $1 million, I have to save $1 million? How am I going to save $1 million? And what if I'm, maybe in your 50s or late 40s, and you haven't even started yet, or older, and you're going,
how
am I going to do that? Yeah.
Right. And almost to the point, like, why even try? It's really hard to get to that. But believe it or not, you can get there, and you can get there relatively quickly, and just doing it in small steps. It is part of it comes down to the magic of compounding. So although you're saving a little bit at a time, over time, that savings gets compounded and accelerates. And you can actually do a really good job, even if you're just getting started in your 50s.
Yeah, I get really tired of all the dismal statistics and all the bad, bad, naughty, naughty, we didn't save enough, retirees are suffering. The fact of the matter is we'll be talking about this on the upcoming Money Track show early next year, that really a lot of Americans have taken control of their situations with well under $1 million by simply adding another 3 or 4 years to work. Mm-hmm. You know, just adding, because if you think about it, that's just that much less money you're spending. It's that much more money you're bringing in. And to your point about compounding, that's when you have the most money saved and you're letting it sit longer and accumulate. So 3 or 4 more years of work ain't so bad. And if you like what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it really makes a difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we look at there's a few levers you can pull. You can work a little longer, you can save a little bit more, or you can be okay with spending a little bit less in retirement. And so if you look at any of those three in and of themselves, one might not be all that palatable, but slight adjustments in each of the three, and you actually can make tons of progress in a short amount
of time.
That's
right. Mm-hmm. So it's not the big dramatic get to the end of the line, of the finish line, or the starting line of retirement, whatever you want to call it, and go, oh, no. It's more like just what you're saying, Jason. Yeah. It's these tiny little tweaks. But getting back to the advice piece,
I was going to say, can be confusing too. How do you choose? There's a lot of advisors out there. What do you look for?
Well, really, truly, the whole reason that I came up with WealthRamp was a way to match consumers to the right fit advisors. So you have to start by, first of all, let's all recognize it's chaotic. So you're not alone and you're not stupid. If you're out there and you think you're looking for an advisor and you don't know where to begin and you can't figure out where to go and you get frustrated, it's a really common problem. It's a huge problem. So you have to, look at it like, okay, this is chaos. And now we know we've got these two types of advisors, those who sell products over here and those who really are, you're paying for their advice. And then going through the process of doing a simple background check is the number one. And that can be done in 10 minutes, Mindy, just by going to the SEC's website or FINRA and do a broker check. It's called FINRA Broker Check. And you go online, and in 10 minutes, you can see your advisor's rap sheet. You can see if there are any disclosures, complaints, lawsuits, liens, etc. It's all public record. So once you've gone and taken that step, once you know an advisor's name, then you probably do want to take into consideration what we're saying today, which is, I want to know how my new advisor, Jason, is getting paid.
Right.
So Jason, if I'm in conversation with you and I'm the client, and you are you as a fiduciary advisor who doesn't just sell products and get a kickback, you actually charge me to give me advice. How does the conversation go? Are you proactive about it, or do you wait for me, the client, to bring up the F word, fees.
Fees.
Fees and fiduciary. That's the new F word.
Always up front. Always transparent. Always up front before any type of agreement is considered or entered into. They know exactly what they're going to be paying.
So that's a good sign.
Right.
That's
if I know I'm talking to a fee-based advisor, number one, and not commission-driven, okay? Right. Big difference there. And then if my advisor is the one who brings up the conversation and doesn't make me do it, but if I do wind up interviewing you and I am the one that who brings it up, what do you feel should be the question to ask about fees? How am I paying you, or how do you recommend?
Yeah. So what are the costs associated with your service, and break that out into every category. So there would be a fee, an advisory fee, and then if there's any mutual funds involved or ETFs or individual stocks, there's typically management fees associated with those funds and ETFs. There could be a charge to enter in and buy or sell a stock. You need to know all that.
Okay, let me back up here.
Yeah,
you're saying there's a fee, there's a charge. Is it the same? Is it matter how much money? Let's say I don't have a lot of money, and I'd like some advice, but I don't have a lot of money to pay you. And I don't know, do I have So is it based on how much money I have and I'm investing, or is it a flat fee?
It can be either. It can be either a flat fee, or it can be based on the amount of assets that you're investing. But it's important to note that if you were to go by yourself without Jason, mm-hmm. and you were just going to go make that investment at Schwab or Fidelity or wherever, you're still going to have to pay something mm-hmm. in transaction fees. And what Jason's point is that over here he's going to list out, this is how much the brokerage firm of Schwab, where we're keeping your money, mm-hmm. or it's your choice to choose the brokerage firm. Vanguard, whatever. Here's what they charge, whether you came through me or whether you did it mm-hmm. yourself. And then over here, Mindy, because you're talking about a smaller amount of money, and you don't need me to actually manage your money, you need me to give you advice, mm-hmm. then I'm going to charge you a flat fee. I might even be willing to do a one-time consultation with you where you pay me a fee to give you a retirement readiness report, a software-driven report that tells you how to get the most out of your Social Security, how to get, the most out of your investments, money for life, mm-hmm. and charge you one fee for that one report. Maybe it's $250.
Right.
You walk away, maybe you come back next year, but you've got a roadmap.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Let's kind of, we've been talking about retirement. Let's talk about college, saving for college. Look what's happened. Look at the colleges, what they're charging now compared to when we were in college. It's crazy. So, so how do you know how much to save for college?
It's a great question, and I have a feeling as we get through this segment, I'm going to sound like an adult diaper commercial because it depends. It really does. So, if we think about, look at in-state public for your college education, it's one cost. And just ballpark numbers, about $15,000 in state. If you go out of state, you can almost double that to about $30,000. And if you go private, you add another $10,000 to $15,000 a year. So depending on where your child goes to school, whole range of
And you
of
don't
costs.
Know where that's going to be.
And
you certainly don't know when they're when. And you should start saving when. When do you start the college fund?
So I often counsel my clients, let's shoot for something in the middle because we don't really know where they're going to end up. We do know that college costs are growing much faster even than healthcare costs lately. So it's one of the fastest increasing costs out there. So we do need to manage that. We want to try to get ahead of that curve. So let's start saving. 529s are a great way to do that. There's many options, but those are one good place to start. And then as things go, as time goes by, as the child develops, we've got a better sense of what might be. Mm-hmm. And then we can start getting really much more specific on saving strategies.
Let's say you've got this money in this 529, and then your son or daughter or grandchild decides they're not going to go to college. Or maybe you want to use that money earlier and you want to send them to private school. They're in public school and you want to, can you use that money for something other than college?
You can actually now, I think you can shift the money from one child to the next. So if you've saved for, your daughter, and then she goes, you know what, I'm going to Europe. See ya. By the way, can I have your credit card?
Yeah.
And then that other child, the son, let's say, comes up and he wants to go to college and he wasn't able to save as much, I think you can actually use some of that money or that money
you
for
can,
that
you can change the beneficiary to just about anybody.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But what you can't do is you can't use those funds for private school.
Oh, you cannot.
No, it's got to be post. I mean, it could be a private college.
Oh, but it has to be college.
Got to be college.
All right.
Right.
So is it ever true that having money in a college savings account actually results in a college reducing the amount of grants that is given to your child?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. But here's an important thing to know. So assets do count. There is this federal form that you have to fill out. And for 529 plans, it's about a 5% of the value that's taken into account as a negative against financial aid eligibility. Here's the big difference, though. Income counts for about 10 times as much or about 47%. So don't not save in a 529 because it's going to go against you. A very small portion does. Much better to you know, get ahead of the game and start saving for college. Absolutely.
You're saying the parents' income.
Yeah.
Parents' income.
Matters.
Yeah.
Matters. Almost, greatly.
Yeah.
Okay.
About 10 times more than what that asset is.
And at what age does the parents' income not become a factor any longer?
I believe there's a 2-year look back. Mm-hmm. So up until 2 years before the first child enters college, they're going to look back, and if you made $100,000 a year, they're going to assume that about $47,000 is available for college.
Wow.
Now, if you have multiple kids in college, then that's reduced a little bit. They recognize that, but it's
a big
hurdle.
Two quick points about saving for college. Number one, really important for women especially. You know, women tend to feel that, oh my gosh, you know, I have to save for my child's college education, and therefore I'll put my retirement savings on hold. And that's like the biggest mistake, because it's just like on the airplane. When the mask drops down, you have to take care of yourself first, or you can't take care of your kid.
Right.
Or else your kid is going to take care of you later because you can't take care of yourself. So really, you have to save for retirement. And while you want to help your child, you also know that there's all kinds of financial aid and grants. And then one quick point about grants, okay, just private grants. Yeah. The least known fact about getting a grant is that the child needs to apply to the grant. They get rejected. They need to reapply and reapply and reapply. And reapply. And that's how most kids end up getting those grants.
That's good to know. All right. Jane says, I'm a financial advisor and I use a comprehensive software program to feed all of the information into when analyzing a prospect or client's retirement situation. I have found that the single biggest impact to a lifetime income plan is expenses. You can increase income or returns, but by decreasing expenses, the impact is far greater over the long haul. Just my 2 cents. Do you guys agree?
Great point.
We did a story on Money Track, where Jason was the advisor that did a makeover on a very wealthy family from Falmouth. And the husband graduated from Tufts with a math degree. And they had two financial advisors that they were paying. They had a very big lifestyle.
Yeah.
Boat, few houses, etc. Anyway, it turns out Jason looked at what they were spending and asked them, what do you think you're spending per month? And Steve's answer was something like, oh, you know, around $13,000 a month. And Jason looked at it and goes, no.
Double that? I don't remember. That was a while ago, but it was a big number.
To Jane's point, I mean, trim-tabbing the spending.
When we go through that planning analysis and preparation, we look at, or I try to break it out into needs, wants, wishes, right?
So needs, wants, wishes.
Needs, wants, wishes. So what do you need? That is utility bill. You got to keep the lights on, you got to keep food on the table, clothes on the back, et cetera. And then we build from there.
All right.
So expenses, absolutely.
All right, so we've got just a couple minutes left. How early should we be helping children understand the importance of investing, and how do we start that?
Oh, my goodness. I'm on the board of Jumpstart, which is the coalition to increase financial literacy in schools K through 12, especially public schools, especially economically disadvantaged areas. And I can tell you that students and as much as parents rail against the idea that, you know, my kids are not learning anything about personal finance or investing or economics in school. I can tell you that parents are the ones who have the biggest influence on their child's money behavior. And you can do the simplest things to teach your kids at age 6, 7, 8, 9, and onward.
Yeah, since my girls were about 2, I've got identical twins, 2 years old. They've known, I've instilled, drilled in them the golden rule, which is to save 20%. Now that they are in sixth grade, they're learning percentages and multiplication. So they actually know what 20% means now. So I started that very young. Their birthday money and et cetera, we invested in a broad-based Vanguard index fund. So anytime we go to Walmart or a Disney or something, I talk about them owning a little piece of that company.
That's right. Yeah. That's the benefit of having a financial advisor as a father.
Jason Lilly, a managing partner at ARC Wealth Advisors, and Pam Kruger, co-host of PBS's Money Track. Thank you both. Always great to see you.
Thanks, Mindy. Appreciate it.